A new Harvard study finds nearly 4,600 people died in Puerto Rico as a result of Hurricane Maria. That's more than 70 times higher than the official death toll, which stands at just 64. The research out earlier this week is renewing questions about why the official count is so low and about the Puerto Rican government's lack of transparency when it comes to the way it calculates the number of people who died as a result of the storm. Aurelis Hernandez is a reporter for The Washington Post covering the aftermath of Hurricane Maria. She's from Puerto Rico, lived there for 2 months earlier this year. Aurelis, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Well, you open a recent piece for The Post with the story of one woman's death in Puerto Rico. Tell us about Yvette Leon.
Well, Yvette Leon was a 50-plus-year-old mother of two adult children. She was active in her local Boy Scouts. She was a community leader. She was the kind of person who, when, you know, this blackout happened, gave all her neighbors whistles so that they could, you know, sound off in an emergency amid the darkness. She was moderately healthy. She didn't have any chronic diseases per her family. And she got sick around Thanksgiving Day. This was several weeks after she had gone about sort of giving out donations to some of the harder hit towns in Puerto Rico. And she got very, very sick. She was vomiting. She had chills. She found blood in her stool. She went to the hospital, was never admitted, but was treated through an IV and got some prescription antibiotics and was told that she had diverticulitis. About 18 hours after she went to the hospital, again, having never been admitted, just got getting this IV in the emergency room and being told to go home, she died. She died in her daughter's arms before paramedics could get there on time to try to administer any kind of life-saving help. And this is just one story. There are many stories like this where there was an issue either with access to health care or there was an issue with some sort of mysterious ailment that came about or access to paramedics or help of any kind that resulted in the death of a loved one in Puerto Rico.
And yeah, a lot of those stories where, in this case, the paramedics couldn't get there quickly enough in part because of infrastructure trouble, I understand, lack of power to power medical supplies, things like that. A lot of people died indirectly as a result in some ways of the hurricane. That's not counted in the official death toll.
Well, we actually don't know how the Puerto Rican government is counting these deaths. So according to CDC guidelines, some of the issues that arise after a natural disaster, something like, you know, the collapse of the electrical system and someone dying as a result of that system not being in place, could potentially be included in what is a list of attributable deaths. But because we don't actually know what guidelines, what protocols the Puerto Rican government is using to classify and certify these deaths, I wouldn't be able to tell you one way or the other, you know, who they're saying is in and who they're saying is out.
And what is this Harvard study doing differently to find really 70 times more deaths as a result of the hurricane?
Right. So the Harvard study, it was a household survey, right? And they're estimating, they're using the little bit of data that was provided by the Department of Health and Demographic Registry for, I think it was September, October, November. It was incomplete data. But data to sort of estimate and take surveys from household to household that they chose that would be a representative sample to sort of get an idea of, you know, these stories and how many people died. And their estimate, remember, we're talking about a range there. The sort of the median range was 4,000, more than 4,600. But their range included anywhere from about 800 to 8,000 in terms of the number of people who may have actually died in this natural disaster. Now, when they say the number of people died, we're talking about in excess of what the number of people who typically die in a certain time frame or time period. And so Harvard is not saying that all of these are attributable to the hurricane. What they're saying is up to this number of people, many people died during this time period in excess of what is the norm.
As I understand it, this isn't just an argument about getting the past right, getting the history right in these numbers. It's also about preparing for the next hurricane season, which starts, I think, today.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely starts today. I mean, you have a Puerto Rico now that still has about 11,000 power customers without electricity. If we were to extrapolate that and assume that 2 to 3 people live in every household, we're talking about 30,000 people who've been living without electricity, I think now for more than 8 months. And so, you know, in a system that has been publicly sort of declared not ready for another hurricane. I mean, certainly there would be few systems, you know, capable of withstanding a Category 5 or 4 storm, but Puerto Rico system in particular is sort of in patch mode. The federal government and the local government have not even entered that phase where they can harden the system to such a degree. And it was in large part because of those issues with electricity that it crippled every part of this system, from, you know, hospitals and medical emergency medical personnel to being able to get on the phone and access information or getting your prescriptions, that led to a lot of the death that we saw occur in the aftermath of the storm.
We're talking to Aurelis Hernandez, a reporter with the Washington Post, about the death toll in Puerto Rico after Hurricane Maria. New research says the numbers are actually much higher than the official estimates. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think about how the government responded after Hurricane Maria? Do you think we've been paying enough attention to what's been a slow recovery on this American territory? Do you have family yourself in Puerto Rico who were affected by the hurricane? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. We continue our conversation about the aftermath of Hurricane Maria in Puerto Rico. A new study says the death toll is likely much higher than the official count, and the island in many ways not ready for the new hurricane season. Aurelis Hernandez is with us from the Washington Post. She's been covering the aftermath of the hurricane. Aurelis, you shared on Twitter some of your notes. You surveyed mayors around Puerto Rico, asked them, are you ready now for the new hurricane season? What kind of responses did you get?
Oh, that was actually Leila Santiago from CNN. Yeah, no, but that's okay. I mean, I think unequivocally, I think her notes, I saw that tweet as well, was that no one seems to have any degree of confidence that they are ready for the hurricane season, should another one like Maria come by.
And talking to people on Puerto Rico, on the island itself after the hurricane, do you get a sense that they feel forgotten by the rest of the United States?
Absolutely. I mean, I think that's across the board. I talked to hundreds of people in my three or four trips now back and forth to Puerto Rico, and that's the predominant sentiment, is this feeling of having been abandoned and forgotten, you know, while this struggle continues for a lot of the folks who live there.
And one thing that struck me about some of the reporting that you and your colleagues at the Post have done is, apart from the fatalities and the tragedies, the schools. A lot of kids, at least for a semester, their schools were empty. They weren't ready to accept students. You had teachers showing up at empty schools waiting for the day when kids come back.
Right. No, we did a piece, an immersive sort of digital experience, where we looked at one particular school in the town of Utuado. And yes, there were many, many schools across the island in the 2, 3, 4 months after the storm that didn't have water or electricity and could not be open. And for so many of those communities, those schools are a central sort of network and community center for a lot of these families. In some cases, you know, for poorer families, the only place where they will get a hot meal, you know, reliably once or twice a day. And so, you know, the program of closing some of these schools, the territorial government, because of cost savings, because of enrollment issues, we're talking about somewhere near 300 schools are expected to close, I think, in the next month.
And also in that immersive multimedia project, the sound of generators in many communities, generators meant to, you know, tide you over for a day or two here and there, people trying to live off of them for months at a time.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, if you didn't have a generator, you didn't have a way to keep your refrigerator cool. If you were diabetic, you didn't have a means by which to keep your insulin cool. And so for a lot of people, the power generator became a lifeline. They'd spend, you know, the couple $100 it needed, and then we're spending in excess of $40 to $60 a week to put in the gas and to get change the oil and whatnot, and turn it on for only a certain number of hours, either overnight or in the evening, and that was ubiquitous. I mean, around 6 o'clock, as the sun was falling, and I remember around November, it was just like, just clicked on, the sound of the power generator was, the buzzing, that is, was even louder than the native frogs that sing out there.
For months after the hurricane, we heard about problems accessing safe, clean drinking water. What's the situation now?
The situation has greatly improved, and so a lot of Puerto Rico's water system is a system of water pumps and wells. And so when the electricity went out, a lot of these wells didn't have the power to be able to run those pumps to get them going. FEMA actually intervened in that and provided many generators, and still to this day there are a number of these pumps, particularly in rural and mountainous communities, where these power generators are keeping that lifeline alive. Also keep in mind, if there were a lot of landslides in the center of the island, and so a lot of the piping and the infrastructure was damaged by some of the geographic dislodgement that or the ground moving, essentially. And so things are much better now. There's a much more reliable sort of source of water, but as long as that that generator is going, as long as there's some kind of backup system for these water pumps, it will continue to serve folks out there.
And briefly, as we wrap up, again, a new hurricane season starts today. Is the infrastructure being rebuilt in a way that would hopefully, to the extent it has been rebuilt, in a way that will hopefully be able to weather future storms?
The last I checked, there were plans to make that, to build Puerto Rico stronger. The problem is that things have taken so long to get back to a sense of normalcy that it's unclear whether the actual building has taken place. There are a few new bridges across rural communities that collapse across rivers that are temporary fixes. But in terms of hardening that infrastructure, I'm not clear on the evidence that that's actually taking place.
We'll leave it there for now. Aurelis, thanks a lot for joining us today.
My pleasure.
Aurelis Hernandez, a reporter for The Washington Post, covering the aftermath of Hurricane Maria in Puerto Rico. She was with us to talk about conditions on the island now and a new study that finds the death toll from Hurricane Maria was likely much, much higher than the official count. For the next few weeks, Wisconsin Public Radio will air profiles of almost a dozen candidates for governor. We begin today with a look at Governor Scott Walker, who's seeking his third term. As Sean Johnson reports, the lack of a clear Democratic challenger has given Walker a chance to run an upbeat campaign.
When Scott Walker stopped at a Shopko department store near Pewaukee to promote his new $100 per child tax credit, the mood was relaxed and so was the governor. About a dozen reporters showed up to watch, and about a dozen employees did too. Walker talked with a few of them on his way in about what he'd heard from a parent of 10 kids at a previous stop.
She said, "Here are my kids. That's a grand right there." I said, "Wow."
As he moved to a microphone set up in front of the kids' sportswear section, Walker said the child tax credit was another way to give back to taxpayers. He said Democrats who call the checks election year bribes are really just knocking him.
Let's just be honest here. State Democrats, you fill in the blank, they're opposed to whatever I'm for.
The approach has carried over to Walker's advertising. He's run 4 TV ads, mostly featuring people who got private sector jobs with the help of state government.
Yeah, it gives us a leg up.
Wisconsin is working.
Larry Sabato is the director of the Center for Politics at the University of Virginia. He says there's a chance Walker's positive approach is aimed more at Democratic voters than it is Republicans.
Maybe he's trying to melt a little of the intensity of the Democrats in opposing him.
The last few years, however, have not been without controversy. In 2014, Walker dismissed suggestions that he would sign a right-to-work law or run for president. In 2015, he did both. And last year, Walker negotiated a contract that could pay tech giant Foxconn up to $4.5 billion in taxpayer money to build TV screens in Wisconsin. Democratic Congressman Mark Pocan of Madison says he tells the governor's opponents that Foxconn is their ticket to beat Walker.
I have told them all the exact same thing, that Foxconn is radioactive toxic across the state.
But there are at least some Democrats who worry that their party still hasn't figured out what it takes to beat the governor. Democratic consultant Scott Witkoff, who is advising Mike McCabe in the governor's race, says it's not enough to just attack Walker.
The problem with that is that resonates with the choir. And the slice of the pie in terms of political discourse that aligns with the choir has been shrinking.
Former conservative talk radio host Jerry Bader, who's now the communications director for Media Trackers, thinks Democrats have demonized Walker so much that they've lost credibility.
A lot of the gloom and doom stuff that they predicted did not come to pass.
Walker has even gone so far as to suggest this year that Democrats are filled with anger and hatred toward him. He references a comment by State Superintendent of Public Instruction Tony Evers, who called Walker an idiot for rejecting federal Medicaid funds.
I think a lot of voters are shocked to think that people that hold office would call other people in office things like that.
There is, of course, a more prominent office holder who uses insults as a political tool all the time.
Comey's a liar and a leaker. Maxine Waters, a very low IQ individual.
President Donald Trump, the leader of the Republican Party, used insults to get elected and continues to use them in the White House. Walker supports the president, but downplays suggestions that Trump makes his case more difficult.
You know, Washington is a whole different place, but I think the contrast is if people don't like what's happening in Washington with anybody, Democrat, Republican alike, if they don't like the tone there, we're the cure to that.
Walker's political instincts have served him well in Wisconsin, where he's won three statewide elections in the past 8 years. But at least 10 Democrats are hoping they'll be the one to end the winning streak. Sean Johnson, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Coming up Monday on Central Time, the state's Department of Corrections says it will stop the use of pepper spray in Wisconsin's youth prisons. We'll get the details on that and other outcomes of a court settlement. As the school year winds down in districts around the state, we'll meet Wisconsin's Teacher of the Year. And where are the jet cars and meals in pill form? A science writer looks at the technology we thought was coming but never did. And we'll pick up that series of profiles of candidates for governor starting Monday next week. A lot of Democratic candidates to check out. You can hear those profiles each day on Central Time at 4:55 and 6:55 each evening. You can also find them all as they appear on WPR.org. You can hear all that, plus look at some of the top news stories of the day. It's coming up Monday right here on Central Time.